Chapter 11. Some of the more superstitious amongst Abbeydale's population were heard to say that Marie Skibbo had taken the villagers' luck with her when she departed. There was no change in their physical circumstances, but they seemed to suffer a veritable plague of depressing and unfortunate incidents. Marie had been right about her family's reaction. After the truth was finally established, Rye Mulvey confirmed she boarded the Coogan, Scott Williams confirmed she was loading the thermal furnace when it cast off, Gerald Skibbo's reaction to what he thought of as his daughter's betrayal was pure fury. He demanded Paul Manani either chase after the tramp trader on his horse or use his communication block to have the county sheriff arrest her when the Coogan sailed past Schuster. Paul politely explained that Marie was now legally an adult and didn't have a settlement contract with the LBC and was therefore free to do as she pleased. Gerald, with Lauren weeping quietly at his side, raged at the injustice, then went on to complain bitterly of the incompetence of the LBC's local representatives, at which point the IVET supervisor, exhausted from leading the search for Gwyn Laws after a full day spent in the saddle rounding up stray animals on the savannah, came very close to punching Gerald Skibbo's lights out. Rye Mulvey, Horst Elwes, and Leslie Atcliffe had to pull them apart. Marie Skibbo's name was never mentioned again. The fields and plantations carved out of the jungle at the rear of Abbeydale's clearing were now so large that the vigorous ground creepers which invaded the rotivated soil were growing back almost as fast as they could be chopped up. It was a wearisome task, taxing even the disciplined Ivets. Any further expansion was clearly out of the question until the first batch of crops was firmly established. The more delicate varieties of terrestrial vegetables were struggling laboriously under the never-ending assault from the rain. Even with their genering, tomatoes, courgettes, lettuce, kale, celeriac, and aubergines laboured upwards, their leaves bent and drooping, yellowing around the edges. One violent storm, which left the jungle shrouded in mist for days afterwards, scattered half of the village's chickens, few of which were ever found. A fortnight after the Coogan departed, another tramp trader, the Louis Leonid, arrived. There was almost a riot at the prices the captain charged. He cast off hurriedly, swearing to warn every boat in the Julis Basin to avoid the Qualheim tributary in future. And there were the deaths as well. After Gwyn Laws, there was Roger Chadwick, drowned in the Qualheim, his body discovered a kilometre downriver. Then the terrible tragedy of the Hoffman family. Donny and Judy, along with their two teenage children, Angie and Thomas, burnt to death in their savannah homestead one night. It wasn't until morning when Frank Carver saw the thin pyre of smoke rising from the ashes that the alarm was raised. The bodies were charred beyond recognition. Even a well-equipped pathology lab would have been hard-pressed to realize that they had all died from having a hunting laser fired through their eyes at 5-centimeter range. Horst Elwes pushed the sharpened bottom of the cross 30 centimetres into the sodden black loam and started to press it in with his boot. He had made the cross himself from mayop wood, not as good as anything Leslie could make, of course, but untainted. He felt that was important for little Angie. "There's no proof," he said as he looked down at the pathetically small oblong mound of earth. "Ah," Ruth Hilton said as she handed him Thomas's cross. They went over to the boy's grave. Horst found it very hard to visualize Thomas's face now. The boy had been 13, all smiles, always running everywhere. The cross went in the ground with a sucking sound. "You said yourself they're Satanists," Ruth insisted, "and we damn well know those three colonists were murdered back in Durringham." "Mugged," Horst said. "They were mugged. They were murdered." The cross had Thomas's name burnt in crudely with a fishing blade. "I could have done better than that," Horst thought. "It wouldn't have been much to ask for the poor boy, staying sober while I carved his head marker." "Murdered? Mugged? It happened in a different world, Ruth. Was there ever really such a place as Earth? They say the past is only a memory. I find it very hard to remember Earth now. Does that mean it's gone, do you think?" She looked at him with real concern. He was unshaven and probably hadn't been eating properly. The vegetable garden he kept was choked with weeds and vine tendrils. His beefy figure had thinned down considerably. Most people in Aberdale had lost weight since they'd arrived, but they'd built muscle to compensate. Horst's flesh was starting to hang in folds below his chin.